Greetings and welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Look for us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, a healthcare business intelligence firm, and the chair of the club's End of Life series, of which today's program is a part. Many of us have had experiences with, or at least have heard stories about, individuals whose deaths have involved prolonged sufferings due to interactions with the medical system that ostensibly was trying to help. We like to comfort ourselves with the assurance that we have our own advance directives signed, perhaps we have physicians in the family who can run interference, or perhaps we have the skills and self-confidence to make things go our way. But too often, we find ourselves or our loved ones experiencing the end of life in ways that we just didn't want. Today, we'll hear about a few such specific examples, discuss why these things happen despite our best efforts, and importantly, learn what we can do to prevent them. We've got two speakers to help us out with that today. First, Jackie Speer, who is the Democratic U.S. Representative from California's 14th District. She's a ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, and a member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Now, she has had some professional experience involving legislation around death and dying, but that's really not primarily why she's here today. We invited the Assemblywoman to discuss several somewhat disturbing personal experiences that she's had with elderly relatives at the end of their lives. I believe her examples illustrate just how difficult it can be, even for well-educated, well-connected, highly effective people, to prevent their loved ones from experiencing the stress and suffering that an over-medicalized death too often provides. We also have Dr. Rebecca Sidori, who is Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, where she does both research and clinical work. Her clinical work focuses on her specialties of geriatrics as well as hospice and palliative care. She's also quite a national expert in helping individuals and their families make well-informed decisions, medical decisions, especially around the end of life. Dr. Sidori has published and researched in this area widely and has developed some simple tools to help with advanced care planning, some of which she will share with us today. Assemblywoman Speer will go first, followed by Dr. Sidori. Please help me give our speakers a warm Commonwealth Club welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Mark. I want to compliment all of you for being here. This is not a topic that most people want to talk about or think about, and it has really been enlightening for me over the last 5 or 6 years as we've debated the Affordable Care Act to appreciate how reluctant we are, even now, to discuss this issue. I was just reminded by a member of my staff that we frequently get calls to our office complaining about the death panels, which, as we all know, don't exist. And furthermore, the counseling, which was what was intended to be in the Affordable Care Act, the counseling by physicians with their patients, is not reimbursed. Kaiser Family Foundation just did a study recently in which they found that 90% of those they polled wanted to have their doctors talk to them about end-of-life decisions. And 81% thought that Medicare should pay for it. And only 17% of physicians actually provide that counseling. So we are in that kind of never-never land where no one wants to think about it, everyone wants their physicians to provide it, and no one's willing to pay for it. So I came to this issue over many years in the state legislature where I served on the health and insurance committees, knowing a lot about how we spend our money, knowing full well that 25% of Medicare dollars are spent in the last year of life, and that many studies have shown that hospice services actually is preferable for the patient in that their lives are extended more by having hospice care than by having standard treatment. So I knew all of that information. And then my mother, who was 93 years of age, got sick enough that she was in the hospital and was suffering from a number of cardiac situations. And so her cardiologist came to me and says, well, we want to do an angioplasty on her. She's 93 years old. And I said, well, I don't know that we need to do that. I mean, I'd rather have her just enjoy the last months or years of her life and not have any complications associated with, more intervention. And he looked at me kind of shocked, because physicians are always there feeling compelled to treat. And his answer to me was, well, let's ask your mother. Now, my mother at 93 was immortal. She was going to live forever. So he went in to talk to her and said, do you want this angioplasty? And from her perspective, of course she wanted it. Now, if you had gone into her and said, well, you're going to have to pay a 20% or 30% copay on this, she would have said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. But since Medicare is kind of a freebie in some respects to many, if you've got Medicare and you've got a wraparound plan, you're not putting any out-of-pocket money for much of your care. So she said yes. So she had the angioplasty. She was living with us in our home. And over the course of the next 8 months was, slowly deteriorating, but was on oxygen, but still moving around and would go outside in the backyard and do her exercises, kicking her feet up and the like. And finally it was time to bring in the hospice nurses. And I said to the hospice nurse, now the one thing you can't do is tell her that you're a hospice nurse. Because, of course, she's going to live forever. So she agreed to do that. Now, technically they shouldn't do that, but she accommodated me. And so my mom had her first visit with the hospice nurse, and I came home from D.C. that night, and she complained to me that I got home too late, and, it was too late to eat, and so I gave her some Ensure. And then woke up at 3 in the morning to check on her, and she was starting to, she had foam around her mouth, and I was thinking, oh, well, maybe she didn't swallow all the Ensure. So I called the hospice nurse, and the hospice nurse said no, that she is beginning to pass. And so I woke up my then younger daughter, and we just stayed with her as the next 3 or 4 hours passed, and she died. Very peaceful life. So she literally died in her sleep. Also living with us at the time was my mother-in-law. So we had my mother who was virtually deaf and my mother-in-law who was now almost blind living with us for the last years of their lives. So my mother-in-law, 4 months later, we had just come back from Mother's Day services and brunch, and she wasn't feeling so good. And she had, a number of issues. She was 87 years old. And as the night wore on, we took her to the emergency room, and she had a blockage. And so the doctor wanted to do surgery on her. I, of course, was of the opinion that that was not necessarily the best avenue, but in fact, the blockage over a period of time would be very, very dangerous. So they did the surgery. She never really came out of the surgery. For the next 3 days, she was hospitalized. And we were, at her bed, and the nurse comes in and wants to give her an antibiotic, an injection. And I look at her, and I'm thinking, are you kidding me? And I said, no, don't do this. We knew she was within hours of passing. And she looked at me kind of shocked and then left the room. So my mother-in-law died in the hospital with tubes and injections and all the things that she really didn't want. Fast forward 3 years later, my father was then living with us. And he was complaining about this pain in his back. And it was getting more painful. So I took him to the hospital to be scanned, get a bone scan. They did the bone scan, and they found out that his prostate cancer that had been first diagnosed 10 years before had metastasized to the bone. So we were in the hospital. I spent the night with him, and I said, we're getting out of here. And so I arranged for transport. I took him home. We got a hospital bed into the bedroom. The hospice nurse came. The expectation was he'd have 5 to 6 weeks. This was Labor Day weekend, so this was on a Friday. He was comfortable. Saturday, he was, you know, very lucid. He was on morphine, of course, but was lucid, telling stories. Sunday, he started to sleep more and more, and he passed away on Labor Day. So the hospice services that were provided to both my parents were very short in duration, which is another aspect that we hopefully will be dealing with in a more rational way as we become more educated, because hospice care is great care, but it's oftentimes offered very late in life. And so the benefits are not enjoyed by those who could gain the most from it. So those were my experiences with end of life, with all the knowledge I had, with all of the experience, and yet it didn't go as I would have liked in most of those cases. I think for my father, it was as good as you could possibly imagine it, considering that we didn't have that serious diagnosis until days before. But it's a great message to all of us that we really need to take charge of how we want to be cared for at the end of life and be very clear and specific to our family members as to what we want done. Thank you.
Those were some incredibly powerful stories, and I've heard them before, and every time I do hear them, it really just makes me fired up about the fact that I feel like we just need a revolution. And when I say that, I think it's not only in the medical realm, but we need to sort of stand up as sort of a community to figure out how can we do these things differently. And I think I've spent a lot of my career trying to kind of power to the people, because you might not always get that physician who understands or who has been trained. And so what can we do to sort of do this as a community, not only in the, you know, not only in Congress, not only in our hospitals, but also sort of in our communities. And so that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today. You know, and the first thing is, you know, how does this spiral of unwanted care happen? And Congresswoman Speier talked about how doctors, you know, were trained to do treatments. So the saying goes that if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And we are trained to use the tools in our toolbox. And I think sometimes we forget that the person is a whole person, and maybe those tools aren't the best tools for them. So I think that's one of the things that happens. And I also think when I see some of these communication breakdowns that happen, you know, what are some of the deficits? And I think, as I was saying, patients are often not empowered with the information they need to make informed medical decisions for themselves. There's often a power differential in that situation with a clinician, and how do you stand up for yourself? And, you know, as the Congresswoman was saying, if you haven't had these discussions and haven't been empowered to know what's important to you so you can tell your loved ones might be in situations where they're not empowered to make decisions. So I think the question is, how do we preserve our stories? How do we preserve ourselves and what's important to us and how we want to live our lives? And I've spent a lot of time doing research and thinking about this and writing about sort of redefining what we talk about planning when we talk about advanced care planning. And so the idea is maybe redefining this planning and advanced care planning from just filling out advanced directive forms about CPR and mechanical ventilation to really preparing people to make complex, ongoing decisions over time and preparing people to communicate effectively when they're in those situations in the medical environment. And really sort of asking the right questions. So is it just about CPR, or is it really about what brings life meaning? And again, how we want to live. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So the traditional objective of advanced care planning, if you don't know, is to have people make treatment decisions, like I said, about CPR or mechanical ventilation in advance of serious illness. And this is in an attempt to provide care that's consistent with somebody's goals, and that's a good thing. Advanced directive legal forms or living wills are the ways that this has usually been done. And I like to call this the one and done sort of situation. Sort of clinicians and lawyers, we like our check boxes and we want to ask, do you want to be on a breathing machine or not? Yes or no? Can we check the box? And then can I just sort of be done with this because it's, you know, Congressman was saying this is either very uncomfortable conversations and let's just do it once and never talk about it again. You know, and even so, advanced care plans are often not completed. So I think the problems with advanced directives, again, they only talk about this very narrow set of treatment decisions at the very end of life, but not about all the other decisions that somebody might be making up until that point. We know that over 55% of seriously ill older adults haven't completed an advanced directive. These forms are written from a legal perspective, so they have very difficult legal language and can be difficult to understand. And again, they're not really preparing people for decision making and for some of those other decisions that might come up. And unfortunately, clinicians are not trained and have limited time to have the discussions. So I just want to say that I do think advanced directives are critically important. And I want to refer people sort of to our easy-to-read advanced directive that we had. This is written at a fifth-grade reading level and has pictures that help explain the text. And I'll just tell you, we've done randomized control trials that show that this is wildly successful. And even people with high literacy prefer this form because it's just easier to understand. It is available at the Institute for Healthcare Advancement website. So I do think advanced directives are important, but are advanced directives enough? Mm-hmm. It's at the Institute for Healthcare Advancement. It's IHA, the number 4, health.org. And so getting back to, you know, advanced directives are important, but really, are they enough to sort of deal with all of the problems related to end-of-life care? And we've done a series of focus groups with patients and their loved ones, and I'm just going to read you a quote from a woman who was her husband's surrogate decision maker. And she said, "We got the DNR, or do not resuscitate, in writing. But in making the decisions, which there were many, that was just one. Because the first decision was to put him in a nursing home. We were married 30 years, and I could no longer take care of him. Then the second decision was whether to put him on a feeding tube because he had stopped eating and I wasn't ready to let him go." A lot of decisions that people need to make sort of over time. And I think we sort of know inherently that no form or checkbox will ever eliminate the uncertainty or the complexity of the human condition, that will tell you that the medical environment still keeps trying to squeeze people into boxes. And people need better preparation. And we know that unprepared patients and their families, this results in uninformed choices, a care, that spiral of unwanted care that the Congresswoman spoke about, and studies showing stress and post-traumatic stress disorder from people and their loved ones who have had to make these decisions. So again, how do we prepare to preserve our own stories and to preserve who we are in the medical environment? And again, we've done a lot of work thinking about what is that missing puzzle piece to advanced care planning. And what we've determined is that advanced care planning really should prepare people with skills to identify what is most important to them and how they want to live. And that is evolving and changing over time. And sort of getting back to what Congresswoman Speer said, You know, the time to start this isn't when you're 93. The time to start this isn't when you're at the very end of your life. If we are moving this upstream and this becomes normalized, the idea is that we're having these conversations, people are learning to identify what's important to them as it evolves over time. Advanced care planning should also prepare people with skills to communicate what is important to them, to their loved ones, and importantly to providers, especially if you're in a crisis situation, and make informed decisions either for yourself or for a loved one. So I think one of the other things, again, have we been asking the wrong questions? So I have a picture here of a cart before a horse. I can tell you in the medical environment, what do doctors ask? They ask, do you want to be on a breathing machine? Do you want CPR? Do you want surgery? Do you want angioplasty? That's what they ask, which is what I'm calling the cart. And should we be asking instead, what I'm calling the horse, how your life will be after treatment, how you want to live? Studies show that is what is most important to people. And I feel like if you get nothing out of this talk today, the thing that I hope people walk away from is that it's okay to ask your doctors, what will my life be like after this treatment? What will my life be like after this surgery, after this chemotherapy, if I were to need CPR? What kind of bang for my buck am I going to get if I have angioplasty when I'm 93? And this is another quote that I'm going to read from one of our focus groups. I think sums this up nicely. It says, are we reviving him, sticking the tube in so that he can suffer more? I guess it goes back to what happens if you revive him. Is he going through that whole process again? It's the end result. So again, we've spent a long time thinking about how do we create tools to make this process easier for people where they live, in their homes, in the community, and not just in the medical environment. And so we created free, easy-to-read tools that could be used, like I said, at home and to prepare people before they have to start interacting with their providers and to make medical decisions. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about one of our solutions, which is an interactive multimedia website called Prepare, and it can be found at prepareforyourcare.org. That's prepareforyourcare.org. And just tell you a little bit about the website. So Prepare has 5 steps. 1, choose a medical decision maker. 2, decide what matters most in life. 3, choose flexibility for your decision maker. 4, tell others about your wishes. And 5, ask doctors the right questions. You don't have to do all of these steps. They were set up so people can go to the ones that are most important to them. And I'll just tell you a little bit about creating Prepare. We spent a lot of time working with experts in behavior change and health literacy and palliative care to make a website that would be useful and helpful. We also did 13 focus groups, and I read some quotes from those focus groups today. And those stories that we heard from patients and their loved ones were wrapped right into the website. We did a lot of in-depth interviews with the target population to make sure that we got it right. And I think the cornerstone of the Prepare website are that we use video stories that show how to do something. So we don't just say that you should, we actually show people how to do it. And again, Angelo Volandes from Advanced Care Planning Decisions will be talking in November about the power of video stories. So also in creating Prepare, we really, again, wanted to make sure that it's easy to understand. So it's written at a 5th grade reading level with large font. Again, we find that even people with high literacy skills for this kind of emotional content prefer easy to understand information. There's voiceovers, there's closed captioning, and there's really a range of video stories and experiences. We tailored the information to people who, you know, have differing surrogate availabilities and decision-making preferences. So just to tell you a little bit more about it, I'm showing some screenshots from the website that, again, really focus on how to do something. So how to ask somebody to be your medical decision maker. And this video would show people actually how asking someone to play that role. So you can watch how somebody would do that. We follow that up with actually words that somebody could say if they wanted to ask somebody to be a surrogate. And to be honest, you could also just sit on the couch with someone next to you and hit the play button, and they can watch the video with you. We have video stories about how people have overcome barriers to engaging in advanced care planning, like it's too scary. How do you actually overcome that? How do you tell others about your wishes? How do you ask the right questions of your doctors? Again, how do you actually speak up and say, what's my life going to be like after this treatment? So people can go through the website. It asks questions about their values and goals and preferences that people can write their own stories within the website, and the website actually pulls that information out so that people can use it to talk to their loved ones and their family and friends. There's also something gets printed out for the medical provider so that someone could go and have a conversation with their doctor. I'll just briefly tell you that we've done studies with the PREPARE website and have shown that it increases engagement in advanced care planning, more discussions and documentation. In this study, we did some piloting in low-income senior centers in San Francisco. The mean age of people in our study were 70 years, and I think the important point were that 92% had never used a computer. And at baseline, these were sort of chronically ill older adults. Only 40% had engaged in some form of advanced care planning. And after watching PREPARE 1 week later, that increased to 100%. And when we asked them how easy was it to use the website, they rated it a 9 out of 10, even though they were not, you know, computer savvy. So I think one of the exciting things for us is that we've recently gotten funding from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation to take our California advanced directives and make them available for all 50 states. But not only to do that, to actually wrap those legal advanced directives into the PREPARE website, so that if you were to go through PREPARE at the end of the day, not only would you have a legal form that has all of those checkboxes, but again, you would have your personal values and goals and stories about yourself within this legal document. Just wanted to say, too, that PREPARE can be viewed like a movie. So some people are going to want to go through it and answer questions about themselves. Some people are not. But the movie version allows sort of for a lot of different utilities. So we actually have created toolkits if somebody wants to create a movie event. So if you wanted to show this information in libraries, churches, or senior centers. There are handouts for people who are interested where we have our easy-to-read advanced directive and pamphlets about the PREPARE website. And I'll just tell you the URLs, again, that you can go to find this information. So the easy-to-read advanced directive is at IHA4health.org, and the PREPARE website can be found at prepareforyourcare.org. Thank you.
It's my responsibility at this point to remind us that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Zitter, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, and our guests are Assemblywoman Jackie Speer and UC San Francisco Associate Professor of Medicine, Dr. Rebecca Sidori. Well, Jackie, thanks for your very moving stories, which really bring to life, I guess I should say, some of the kinds of situations that I have a hunch that many people in this audience have run into or may run into. And Rebecca, thanks for all of your great work. You know, there's an awful lot of people thinking about this, but you are doing some of the most practical, tactical work that can really help people. And I also appreciate your accountability in doing research to see if it actually works. There's so many things we do in our lives that we hope are working and think are working, but rarely do we actually test in a rigorous fashion to see if they're working. So that helps the entire field learn. So thank you for that. I've got a number of questions for each of you, both my own and from the audience, so we'll jump right to them. Jackie, first of all, you told some very moving stories about three relatives. How did your experiences with them inform your own thinking about and planning for your end of life?
Well, to Rebecca's point, most of these advanced directives aren't specific enough. And I think that in planning for mine, while I already have a living will, and have the specifics articulated in that, I think you need to go much more granularly to the point that, you know, you don't want to be in a hospital setting. If you really do want to have the comfort of your home to end your life, sometimes you don't have that choice, but many times you do. My father could have spent the last few days of his life in that hospital setting, but I made a decision that I was taking him home. So, taking blood samples when someone is in their last hours of life and giving them antibiotics doesn't make a lot of sense either. So you almost have to get that granular if you're going to be in a setting where the normal standard operating procedure is to provide those services.
Can I just say something about that too? Because I think stories are really powerful. And I think, you know, in the clinical environment, we don't use them probably as much as we should. But I think people can use their own experiences and our own stories that have happened to their own family members, something they saw on television, to really help sort of define what is important to them. And you've been through these very specific things, and you can use those stories to talk to your family to say, do you remember when this happened? You know, if I were in those situations, this is what I wouldn't want. So I think the stories can help people frame what's important to them from a medical standpoint and also help people tell others about why something is important or not. And I have to say, even as a physician, when patients come in and say to me, you know, this happened to my mother and I never want this to happen, it is so helpful to me, and I can document that in the medical record. So use your stories.
And Rebecca, you've worked hard to create a system that I think makes it relatively easy for people to have the conversations. I know that those of us in the field are sort of in the funny position of both highly recommending people get an advance directive and warning them it's not enough, right? So you have closed a lot of the gap in terms of what is enough. What's the obstacle to getting more people to use your approach or something similar to it so that people will have the approach that's most likely to get them what they want?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's getting back to what I said sort of in the beginning, that we need sort of a cultural revolution, I think. And this goes back to sort of normalizing. Oftentimes, even when I give talks to a room full of physicians, when I talk about advanced care planning, people say, oh, end of life. I don't want to talk. I'm not going there. I'm not going to talk about it. And again, I think if we start thinking about, I was talking with my assistant, Jana Powell, on the way over here, how we think about insurance, right? You get car insurance, you get health insurance, you start putting money away in your 401k. Why are we not talking about these things way before we have to sort of deal with them? And I think in those ways, it can normalize sort of the topic. It's not, and the other thing too is when you think about advanced care planning, if it's preparing for medical decisions, if it's for preparing and knowing what's important to you, people have a lot of medical decisions to make possibly over their lifetime. Do I have surgery? Do I take that chemotherapy? Do I send my mother to a nursing home? There are so many decisions that need to be made over time that this is a way to help us get the care that makes the most sense for us over our life course, not just at the end of life. And I think if we could reframe that and start this cultural revolution, maybe in this room, that maybe it would make that easier.
Right. Well, I have a comment that says, kudos to Dr. Sidori for phenomenal work, especially in terms of making resources available. Then there's a question here, I'm going to combine with a second question, and it's for Jackie, and it really has to do with what might be a role of government here. Can Congress do something to change end-of-life care? And specifically, and a related question is housing choices. Some people don't want to burden their children, you may not have thought of it as a burden, but certainly you had the burden of caring for parents and parents-in-law. And what resources can be applied there? What's the role of the government in all this?
So the role of government is to encourage this kind of discussion with patients at an early age, and certainly through those Medicare years. Now, the fact that it was politicized to the point where it became radioactive, so that having that reimbursement for the physician to have a 30 or 40 minute conversation with you was not going to be reimbursed because that was, quote, a death panel, is really tragic. And I don't know, frankly, if in the near term we're going to be able to get reimbursement for that service, but I think it's absolutely critical. So that's a role of government, to reimburse physicians for providing that service. I think that we need to do more to encourage the use of hospice much earlier in the cycle of end of life, because certainly my experience suggests that it was very short-lived, and most of the studies suggest that it's short-lived. There is a study that was done, it's probably quite a few years old now, but by Aetna, that actually tracked patients who had the standard treatment of care and had hospice. And what they found was, when they were given the choice of doing both, you didn't have to choose standard care or hospice, you could basically have both, that over a short period of time, the patients gravitated to the hospice care because it was more comprehensive. And they found out that they tended to live longer. So as we educate people on that, I think we'll see a greater use of hospice, which I think is much more humane and, in the end, in many cases, will extend life.
Right. And just a point of fact, I believe, and Becky, you might have some information on this, that as of this year, there is some level of reimbursement for physicians to make some of these discussions, have some of these discussions, not highly utilized at this point and not a lot of money, but I think there's something that's going on there now. On the hospice side, we got one question specifically about hospice, saying, well, hospice may be great, but more and more hospice companies are for-profit. And should we be concerned that when hospice is increasingly provided by for-profit companies, that they'll put the profits ahead of the patients? Is there any, Rebecca, do you know if there's any evidence of that?
I don't know of the evidence of that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you?
Well, there is a greater interest in for-profit hospice, but there are not-for-profit hospice. It reminds me of the debate we've had on for-profit universities versus the not-for-profit. I mean, we've seen how the for-profit typically are taken over by Wall Street interests, and before you know it, it's all about the money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that really requires government to use proper oversight and make sure that there's the kinds of regulations in place that will prevent it from, you know, over-utilization of services or providing, you know, extension of services that aren't really necessary.
Yeah. Again, another good role for government, and it's certainly worth pointing out that there's plenty of for-profit and not-for-profit hospitals and for-profit and not-for-profit insurance companies and so forth. So that seems to be a feature on the landscape overall.
Mostly for-profit insurance companies,
yeah,
actually.
Mostly, but the Blues are primarily not-for-profit. All the Blue Crosses and Blue Shields are the majority.
Well, not here in California.
Yeah, no, not in California, many states. Yes,
Rebecca. I just sort of wanted to make a plug for palliative care and talk about that for a minute, because I think it might actually help with some of these concerns about for-profit, non-for-profit hospice. You know, right now, when somebody goes onto the hospice benefit, it is a sort of a capitated payment, and it becomes very difficult for hospice organizations because, say, somebody wants to get a round of chemotherapy because it will make them feel better, the hospice has to pay for that, and then it creates all of these questions. Can we do palliative chemo, and who pays for it? And or somebody wants to go to the hospital, and who pays for that? But I think the hope is that there can be more funds for palliative care. And for people who don't know what palliative care is, it is sort of a holistic view of care that is sort of an added layer of support for people and their symptoms and their psychological symptoms, regardless of age or stage in health. So you could be going for curative chemotherapy and get palliative care. And studies just like hospice show that people who get palliative care live longer, have higher quality of life. And there are many people who maybe still want to have chemotherapy to even extend their life a little bit, or it's actually providing some comfort for them, and it makes it hard for them to be on hospice, but they're a perfect candidate for palliative care, because palliative care could help treat those symptoms, could do some of the other sort of multidisciplinary psychologic, spiritual support that people are needed during that period of your life before they transition to hospice. So I think we actually need more sort of funding towards palliative care to help in that transition.
There are some questions here about money. I think many of us in the end-of-life world don't want to talk about that first, because then people really think we're just trying to save money by letting you die or helping you die earlier. But to put that aside, certainly you mentioned Medicare spends something like 25% of its resources on the end of life, which is not, I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad number. One would expect it would be somewhat disproportional. But what role, on the one hand, do dollars play in the end of life conversation currently, and what role should they play in the future? We had a question about should we put less money into end of life care and more money into disease prevention, for example? Does it compute that way?
So there's a finite pie. Mm-hmm. And taxpayers only want to pay so much money. Some taxpayers don't want to pay any money, as we've heard this election cycle. But so I think at some point we have to have that discussion. And I err on the side of wanting my kids to have all the preventative care that they need. And the story I told you about my mother, in the end, the cost associated with that angioplasty was, I don't even remember the numbers, tens of thousands of dollars. If she was told, now you can have this, it's probably not going to have any effect on the length of your life, or you can put that money away for your grandchildren's college education, or it will guarantee that they have Medicare when they get older, I know she would have made the right decision in terms of shifting those resources to making sure that Medicare is going to be viable for future generations. And so I think that, you know, that conversation really does need to take place on a much more specific level. But everyone thinks that they've put into the system and they want to get everything out of it they can. What we oftentimes don't realize is that we actually don't fully fund Medicare for the extent of time that we're on it, because we're all living longer now. And so Medicare and the extraordinary personalized medicine that has grown and the injectables for cancer that are very expensive have really, you know, made the Medicare system that much more expensive. So with longer lives, greater interventions that are more expensive, you can see how Medicare can be in great trouble in a very short period of time, 2030, 2040. So unless we're willing to take more out of payroll taxes, right now it's a little over 1% for the employer and the employee, we're going to have to face that reality.
I think the good news for those of us working in the field is that usually good end-of-life care actually costs less than what we're currently spending, which is a lot of money on non-beneficial care. Right?
The other thing that's interesting, the studies are now showing that for those over the age of 73, that the amount of Medicare dollars spent at the end of life is declining. So it's a recognition that, you know, we don't need as much expensive interventions as we once thought we did.
Great, thanks. Rebecca, you are calling for a revolution. You'd like to see different behavior on the stand for the part of patients and probably also on the part of physicians. If you could wave a magic wand and solve one of those problems, getting patients well-educated or doctors well-educated, which would you choose and why?
Oh, do I have to choose?
You got to start with one.
Well, I think I kind of have already chosen because that's what I've sort of dedicated my career to, is really focusing on, you know, and I don't want to call them patients, people. Mm-hmm. And how do we help people where they live sort of talk to their families, start this process? And I have many colleagues who are doing amazing work focusing on clinicians and trying to change those conversations. And I think that that will happen, but I think we've got to come at it at two different levels.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we did have a question from the audience about how best to educate physicians and change their behavior. Do you have some thoughts around that?
Well, I think it's very similar in terms of normalizing this. So for a long time, let's say in primary care, it was a very taboo subject to ask somebody about their sexual health. And now it is just part of the regular old intake that we sort of do. And so I think it just becomes training to where it's just something that we do. We start it early. We have these conversations often. It's just part of the culture. Everybody's doing it. I think one of the things is the studies that show when you talk to primary care doctors, if you talk to cardiologists, if you talk to kidney specialists, you talk to ICU doctors, if you ask each of those groups who should be doing advanced care planning discussions, they all point to somebody else. But if they're all having the conversation, and it's just what we do, we ask, if, you know, if you had your flu shot, if everybody's just asking this conversation, it doesn't become so scary. And I think we can kind of break down some of those barriers. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, I will say is that this is a whole other discussion, but we do a very bad job of documenting some of these discussions. And I think that we could help out our clinical colleagues because maybe you only, I mean, I'm a primary care physician. Maybe I only have 2 minutes, but that doesn't mean I can't start a conversation that I can build upon over time or that somebody else can pick up the torch and continue that conversation. So I think we need to work more in concert together.
Right. I have a question here about a pulsed form. You might explain first what that is, sort of the advanced directive on steroids. And then specifically, is it possible to incorporate the pulsed into some of your other work in terms of the Prepare for Your Care website?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for people who don't know, PULSED stands for Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. So it's different from an advanced directive, which is something that a person can fill out on their own, and it's a physician order. So it was originally started in Oregon. It was originally designed for frail elderly people in the nursing home because what was happening is that they were being, you know, they would get very sick and near the end of their life, and then they would go to the hospital and bad things would happen to them, even though they had said, I don't want to go to the hospital and I just want to focus on comfort. So the idea was that they would create this form that could kind of, it's a bright pink form that would go back and forth with them to the hospital that people would know, hey, this is what these people want. And now it's been adopted in California, I think, for the last at least 5 or 6 years. The nice thing about it, again, it's a physician order, so it's actionable, and people can take it home. EMS, so if you call 911, they know to look for the bright pink form and will know sort of what your wishes are. And yes, we've been talking in terms of how it can be used with Prepare. The nice thing about Prepare is that it sort of allows people to write down, again, all of their wishes, values, and goals. And if you hand that to a physician, I'm just going to tell you that you just saved them a lot of sweat and tears and angst and probably just cut down on the time that you would have these conversations because physicians can't complete that form unless they talk to you. But if you've done some of this preparation work and can come into the doctor and they know sort of what your wishes are, it's going to be making filling out that form and that physician's order a lot easier.
Yeah, and just because to put a fine point on it, the advanced directive is not a physician order. So right. My understanding is if the ambulance comes and the rescue squad comes or whomever and they see you in arrest, even if your advanced directive says don't resuscitate me, that's not a physician order. So typically they are not only likely to but often legally required to resuscitate you against your wishes unless you have a pulsed, which is a physician order. Am I correct in that?
That's not the way it's supposed to work, but I would say that functionally sort of it does work that way if you don't have sort of a loved one who knows your wishes while you're physically there. Yeah.
Great. This is a question really for either of you. It's a couple questions both about what's done elsewhere or here. One question is what approach is taken by health plans such as Kaiser about end-of-life treatment? Is it different from what typically happens? And same question for other countries. Do others do it better, differently from us?
So I think there are some of the Scandinavian countries, if I'm not mistaken, who have a very elaborate process that is seen as kind of the gold standard. I think that, you know, some states obviously are farther along than others. That's why having something from a congressional perspective done nationally would be advantageous. I think that the one issue that we haven't really talked about that should be considered in all of this is aging generally. I was at Calico, which is a Google company just 3 years old in South San Francisco, and they are totally funded by Google, and they're looking at aging. And the point that was made to me was that if we were able to cure all the cancers in the world, on average, people would live an additional 2.6 years. But on average, so obviously some people live much longer. But this whole concept of what are we doing about aging differently and living longer, healthier, is something that we haven't spent a lot of time or money on. And at the National Institute of Health, the one institute that deals with aging only gets $1 billion. Now, that may seem like a lot of money to us, but that's not a lot of money in the big scheme of things in a National Institute of Health that's got over $30 billion in revenues a year. So that's another component of all of this as well.
Right, thanks. Rebecca, as many people know, California has enacted an End-of-Life Care Options Act, which allows for people to, under certain circumstances, for a doctor to help people end their lives, so forth. How will that affect, or how is that affecting advanced care planning efforts?
Well, I think, to be honest, in some ways it's helping, because this has been all over the news and people are talking about it, and I think people are speaking up about they would want that or not want that. So I think in some ways, again, it's a story that we see in the media that we can use actually to kind of increase these discussions. You know, I think there is talk, but there isn't anything finalized about whether or not some of these questions about whether somebody would want to, these type of things to be put on an advance directive, but that is not in the California law at this point.
I know other states in the union have also passed some similar laws, and it seems to be trending in that direction overall. But it's usually not the first thing we think about when we're thinking about advanced care planning. Greg? Jackie, I want to go back to the death panel issue. Clearly, as we all know, that was a big issue back 8 years ago in the last two presidential elections ago. And it was never clear to me how much of what was going on there was true concerns versus just plain politics. I'm sure there was some of each of those things overall. Since then, a lot has happened, though. It's interesting to hear that your staff is still getting some of those calls. But we have had this year, without a lot of fanfare or a lot of controversy, some limited physician reimbursement for these conversations. As you say, they're not being used as widely as they need to be, but something's happening there. We've had the California Act passed, we just discussed, and a few other states, too. So I'm wondering if that's largely blown over as a likely major political issue, or if we still have to worry about that getting in the way.
So it all depends on who's going to be in control of Congress. And to be, you know, quite frank with you, if the Republicans continue to hold majorities in both houses, they've already announced that they're going to use a technique that, frankly, the Democrats used to pass the Affordable Care Act, that they are going to use, it's called reconciliation, that they will use to undermine and repeal the Affordable Care Act. So in terms of the death panels will be used when it's advantageous to try and kill the Affordable Care Act.
And should that be done on the national level? I guess that's an issue because Medicare is a federal program, right? So the states can't do very much about that individually in terms of reimbursement. Correct.
Well, yeah. States could offer, you know, a reimbursement to physicians independent of Medicare if they wanted to, but they would have to create some mechanism to do it. They would have to, you know, provide some funding to insurance companies or something to do it, or provide it through Medicaid.
Yeah, which, of course, is limited in terms of what it does with the population overall. Rebecca, what have you found is the best way to get people to start the end-of-life conversation?
Well, I think, first of all, we know that people are at different, we call them, stages of readiness. So there are some people who've been talking about this for 20 years, love to talk about it, have completed their advance directive when they were 18 years old. And then there
who
are
those people?
I have met some of them. But, you know, there are people who have terminal cancer who just will not have a conversation. So I think you have to meet people where they are. And this idea that, you know, and I think I work with a lot of disenfranchised populations, and there are plenty of people who will never complete an advance directive. They just won't do it. But maybe they'll have conversations. And so I think the first thing is you have to meet people where they are. And like I said, if we're reframing advanced care planning from being just about the end of life, and we're talking about it as a way to prepare yourself for medical decisions and to get your voice heard, which is really what it is, that seems a lot scarier than tell me about your wishes when you're dying. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, changing the way that we talk about it is important.
Mm-hmm. And Jackie, do you see any activity, any discussions in Congress about this right now, or is everyone just waiting for the election?
Everyone's waiting for the election. And actually, we're in recess right now, back in our district, so there won't be anything that will happen on this issue for the rest of this year. And with a new Congress and a new president, you might see either an uptick in engagement on this or, you know, an effort to undermine it. Mm-hmm. It just depends who's going to be the president and what the makeup of the Congress is.
Well, we are going to have to leave it at that because we are out of time. So I'd like to thank our speakers, Assemblywoman Jackie Speer and UCSF Associate Professor of Medicine, Dr. Rebecca Sidori, for their comments. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on the radio or by podcast. I'm Mark Zitter, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.